This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Into the Night is made possible thanks to our loyal, beautiful, and handsome listeners and followers. If you would like to support the production of this podcast, please be sure to follow and subscribe to get updates on when new episodes release, join our Patreon to get access to exclusive content, and share our project with your friends, family, and anyone who loves the world of Five Nights at Freddy's. Thank you once again for listening, my friends, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, and welcome to Into the Night, a Five Nights at Freddy's podcast. I am your host, Nick, and thank you for listening. Oh, don't worry, it's not alcohol. It's hot cocoa. It's freezing this time of year. Now, the highly anticipated sequel to the surprise indie hit Five Nights at Freddy's has finally arrived in theaters. Five Nights at Freddy's 2 The Movie is here, and it's brought with it a full-blown cavalcade of merchandise in tow. Before we talk about the film itself, before we get into the story, tone, or what this sequel is trying to do, I want to take a moment to talk about something adjacent. Something that stood out to me the moment I walked into the theater. Because the landscape around this movie feels different. When the first Freddy's film released, its marketing presence was almost subdued. There wasn't a massive aggressive push. Theaters were barely acknowledging its existence beyond a poster taped to the wall outside the auditorium. And yet, it worked. Word of mouth carried that film further than any promotional campaign ever could. But this time the marketing feels distinct. Not louder, as I don't think Blumhouse invested any more in commercials and advertising this time, but the theaters themselves are absolutely hawking as much merchandise as they can possibly get away with. And don't get me wrong, I fell for it too. Do you really think I'm not going to watch the FNAF 2 movie in a theater that's offering me the chance to eat my popcorn out of Toy Freddy's head, complete with glowing eyes, and not say yes? I don't have children yet. Money isn't a priority. So of course I bought it. Its eyes light up. What fascinates me, however, is how universal this push is. AMC has a Toy Freddy popcorn bucket and a Mr. Cupcake drink holder. Cinemark offers a full stage diorama of the toy animatronics, or a plush Freddy clutching pizza boxes, and the popcorn is inside the boxes. Regal has their own version of the stage performing bucket, and Marcus Theaters are selling what is essentially this film's blink and you'll miss it MacGuffin, the Fast Talker, which is, to a degree, interactable. Now, part of you might be thinking, well, the original Five Nights at Freddy's film broke expectations by being a surprise success. Of course, theaters are going to be trying to capitalize on that. And on the surface, I agree with you and that makes sense. But here's where I have hesitation to believe that's the only reason. I haven't seen this same level of theatrical promotion investment for other major December releases. Films like Avatar or Wicked Part 2, both of those have theater-exclusive merchandise, yes, but not to the same gluttonous degree as Freddy's. So the question becomes unavoidable. Why are theaters pushing and attempting to capitalize more on Five Nights at Freddy's 2 much more aggressively than films that will arguably post higher box office numbers? I think the answer lies in two uncomfortable truths. Not uncomfortable to us, but to theaters in Hollywood. The first is fairly obvious. Theaters are already expecting Avatar and Wicked to make their money. Avatar in particular has become the McDonald's of modern film franchises. Something we all consume, something that makes an unfathomable amount of money. And yet, by next month, no one will be quoting a single line of dialogue, nor will it meaningfully impact the cultural conversation. And I say that fully aware that the last two Avatar films both crossed the billion-dollar mark. But beyond serving as increasingly expensive tech demos for CGI advancement, neither has left much of a cultural footprint, at least not in the way truly formative films tend to do. Wicked, meanwhile, will absolutely perform numbers. There are a lot of single women and theater kids who are going to be giving the chicken jockey kids a run for their money on being the most annoying theatergoers out there, which means theaters themselves don't need to overextend. But the second reason, and the more important one, has everything to do with what's been happening over the past half decade in cinema, specifically the rise of the video game adaptation. In 2023, the Super Mario Bros. Movie crossed $1.3 billion worldwide. Before that, we'd already seen strong financial success in films like Sonic the Hedgehog, Detective Pikachu, and yes, Five Nights at Freddy's. Averaged out, each of these films and their respective franchises were pulling in roughly $400 million each. Adjusted for inflation, that's not far off from what Phase 1 MCU films were earning in the late 2000s. And while Marvel films still technically clear around $600 million per release, that number is steadily shrinking when compared to the highs of Phase 3, especially after a string of projects that failed to generate lasting interest or goodwill. Audience attention is shifting. In studios, and most importantly to our discussion, theaters can feel it. With Illumination already moving forward on a Super Mario Galaxy film, a Donkey Kong spinoff, and a live-action Zelda movie in active development, it's not unreasonable to assume Nintendo is laying the groundwork for its own cinematic ecosystem. And if it works out for Nintendo, you can 100% expect that other game studios are going to jump aboard. So theaters are getting ahead of the curve. Because if you think the merchandising push for FNAF 2 is aggressive, just wait for the next Mario movie. There will be popcorn buckets. There will be drinks, candies, hats, clothing, an avalanche of branded spectacle surrounding what will almost certainly be another billion-dollar release. And speaking from tangential experience, having worked on the front end of bookstores rather than in film exhibition, this behavior is very familiar. To me, it's not dissimilar to how bookstores gradually deprioritized American superhero comics as manga began to take a dominant foothold in that market. Retailers, of course, followed the trend, shelf space shifted, and now, walk into almost any Books A Million or Barnes & Noble here in America, and you'll find entire rows dedicated to plethora of manga, with perhaps a single shelf of Western comics tucked quietly nearby. Theaters are doing the exact same thing. They're not just selling popcorns to stay afloat as theaters suffer from the rise of streaming. They're betting on where culture is going next. Which is also why you're seeing the access media panic. The release of Five Nights at Freddy's 2 has been met with a familiar wave of backlash from critics. And frankly, none of it is surprising. The first film was similarly lambasted by critics. and historically, most video game adaptations tend to hover somewhere around the 50% mark in aggregate reviews, with Freddy's catching the rougher end of the stick by landing closer to the low 20s. Meanwhile, many of these same outlets will continue to hand out near automatic fresh ratings to almost every Marvel release, despite it being increasingly evident that the MCU post-Endgame has had no clear creative direction. But why admit that when you can pretend the system is still working? There's something almost late imperial about it, a kind of cultural Versailles. Lavish festivals, honeyed language, and carefully curated narratives insisting that everything is fine, even as the foundation shifts beneath it. In reality, the will of the audience has turned against those systems, not out of spite, but of exhaustion. Yes, movie critics, believe it or not, people don't like consuming garbage indefinitely.
The first of which is Captain America, Brave New World.
6 months later.
It's bad. It's real bad. It's like eating a hot circle of garbage.
Even films that are widely praised, such as James Gunn's Superman by James Gunn, quickly finds themselves accompanied by reports that they underperformed relative to studio expectations. And that isn't a failure of audience taste. It's a self-inflicted wound. Hollywood has inflated its budgets to the point where success is no longer feasible. When a film carries a reported production budget of $225 million, the reality is that it often needs to make somewhere between $600 and $700 million just to break even, once marketing costs and theater cuts are factored in. That is the modern blockbuster economy. A snake eating its own tail. Money recycling itself through spectacle until there's nothing left to sustain it. And of course, critics, influencers, and YouTube personalities who have tethered their identities and their livelihoods to either the mouse or the Hollywood lifestyle will be the first to defend the system. If a film underperforms, it's your fault for not supporting good cinema. If audiences reject it outright, then suddenly, the audience is the problem. Too ignorant, too unrefined, or depending on the article morally suspect for daring to disengage. I bring all of this up because I want to establish a prediction I've held for quite some time now. Video game adaptations are being positioned as the next dominant cinematic genre, a replacement for the superhero model that's entering its late stage of rigor mortis, to be fair. Theaters need people back in seats, and studios need properties that still carry emotional investment, community loyalty, and cultural momentum after they destroyed all that with their very, very terrible films. And Five Nights at Freddy's sits directly at the center of that shift. Which brings us back to FNAF 2. Despite my own interest, despite how easy it would be for me to shower FNAF 2 with uncritical praise, you know me well enough by now that I don't operate that way. I don't have a qualm about calling things as I see them. Accolades are for when they're earned. Criticism is when it's deserved. So, in the interest of transparency and to subvert expectations a little, I'm going to do something out of nowhere. I'm giving my final rating for the film right now. Before we break the film down piece by piece, I'm giving you my opinion, final rating, 5 being the average. What did I think of the film? This is going to be a controversial 6 out of 10 for me. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Set approximately some time after the first film. I could not tell you exactly how long. Michael Schmidt is attempting, with measured success, to move on from the horrors of Freddy Fazbear's Pizza, having begun to heal from the traumas surrounding the loss of his younger brother, Garrett. Michael is determined to build something resembling a normal life with his little sister, Abby. His aunt from the previous film, who, contrary to what is shown in that film, was not killed by Golden Freddy, after surviving her encounter with the Golden Bear, causes a mass public uproar, recounting her ordeal with manic intensity. Her erratic testimony of killer robots come to life ultimately led to her being institutionalized, but not before igniting a renewed obsession with Fazbear Entertainment. Her story sparked a Fazbear fever of sorts, revitalizing public interest in the brand and the many ghost stories surrounding it, particularly among teenagers and children, and culminating in a local convention called FazFest, transformed into a major town spectacle. Meanwhile, Vanessa, who has healed from her previous knife wound from the last film, has been experiencing nightmares related to her father, who gave her said knife wound. Now free from William Afton's control, she is struggling to cope with a life charted by her own decisions, while Michael tries to help her as they are also involved in a pretty awkward situationship, trauma-bonded a bit from the previous film. On a date, they both help each other with their personal problems, with Michael suggesting to Vanessa that she learns and implements the dreamwalking technique he used to confront his past, while Vanessa tries to coax Michael into telling his younger sister, Abby, the truth about her animatronic friends. That truth being that after the events of the first film, the original robots are nowhere to be found. While Michael has lied to Abby that he's attempting to repair them as they are broken, in reality, it was all just to delay a hard explanation that he has no idea where they are, and even believes that after the death of William Afton, the children simply have no purpose sticking around on Earth anymore, and have moved on to a greater pasture in heaven. To make up for it, Abby receives a Faz Talker from Mike, kind of, as a memento to remember her friends. However, behind the scenes, something is stirring at another Freddy Fazbear location. This establishment was shut down following the mysterious death of Charlotte Emily, the daughter of one of the restaurant's founders. Far grander than the Freddy's we knew, this location boasted elaborate attractions, a riverboat ride, a pull-apart Foxy experience, and a cutting-edge toy animatronic band, all orchestrated by their silent conductor, the Marionette. Now freed from its long slumber after someone stops its music box, the Marionette awakens with a singular goal. Betrayed in life by the adults meant to protect her, she seeks revenge. Taking control of the toy robots, she begins to orchestrate a merciless campaign of violence against the town's parents, intending to make FazFest a blood-soaked reckoning that will leave half the population dead by its conclusion. From the standpoint of a narrative continuation, I do not inherently object to this concept. Michael's arc, as presented here, is effectively completed from the first film, and that, in itself, is a consequence of a deliberate creative choice made in the first film, by stripping the Afton family aspect from Michael, alongside the guilt and responsibility motivation that defined his game counterpart, would be a shame if we doubled down on that. Instead, Michael's role in this film is positioned primarily as a stabilizing presence for Vanessa and Abby, the balancing figure in these two women's lives. Abby, meanwhile, continues to function largely as a way to move the plot forward, a character whose openness and unguarded trust allows these supernatural elements of the story to progress. That said, I think the film misses an opportunity to meaningfully justify her emotional dependence on the animatronics. Given the events of the first film, it would have been far more compelling to explore Abby's lingering need for the ghost children through a lens of social alienation. The film gestures toward this idea that Abby needs the robots, but fails to elaborate exactly why. She is shown to have at least one friend at school, and is even invited to a lunch table after recounting her experiences from the first film. As a result, her desires to reconnect with the animatronics come across less as an emotional necessity and more as a somewhat selfish longing. This problem is compounded by how abstract her connection to the ghost children remains. I don't know why, but Abby does not know their actual names. This bothered me the entire film. She refers to the ghost children as Freddy, Bonnie, and Chica, not their actual ghost names. That distance could have been an intentional thematic choice, but without sufficient groundwork, it undercuts the emotional weight of her attachment to them. How do you not, after at least like a year, not know their real names? Vanessa, by contrast, emerges as the most compelling character in the film, which is ironic given that she now occupies the very thematic space, guilt, responsibility, and inherited sin from the father that once defined Michael Afton in the games. The decision to transfer that emotional burden to Vanessa is not inherently flawed, but it is one the film does not justify beyond she doesn't reveal anything about her past. The idea of being William Afton's child carries so much immense dramatic potential, yet the sequel only scratches the surface of what that revelation could mean. This leads into what I consider the film's central structural weakness: the absence of a clear dominant point of view. The first film avoided this issue almost entirely by anchoring its events firmly into Mike's perspective. Because nearly everything was filtered through his experiences, the audience was given time to understand his motivations, values, and trauma, and crucially, to watch those elements evolve. We see him falter, endure, erupt in moments of righteous fury, be cunning, be careful, and be confident all across the film. Five Nights at Freddy's 2, however, attempts to distribute its attention evenly among Michael, Abby, and Vanessa, and the result is a narrative spread too thin between all three. Each of their respective arcs demands more time than the film can afford to give. At roughly a 90-minute runtime, the movie never feels bloated, but its brevity becomes apparent the moment the credits roll. Vanessa's trauma and dreamwalking sequences are fleeting, despite the story's clear need to further explore life under William Afton's roof and to plant deeper mysteries surrounding the Afton family. We're missing crucial time to put in clues and red herrings to make twists in this film pay off even grander. Abby's storyline requires greater emphasis on why the Fazbear Band is emotionally essential to her. And Michael, while no longer in need of a personal arc, still warrants more screen time in the physical space of Freddy's itself, where tension, dread, and the franchise's iconic imagery can be allowed to not only breathe, but allow us to take it all in. Instead, much of the film's iconography is reduced to fleeting cameos and surface-level references, moments that invite the audience to point at the screen and say, "I know the thing!" rather than letting those elements organically reinforce suspense. The result is a sequel rich in ideas, but unfortunately constrained somewhat by its own runtime and implementing its ideas a bit too quickly that it's not able to exploit everything it could to make those ideas really sufficient. This feeds directly into one of the sequel's more pronounced shortcomings when compared to the first film, its tonal and rhythmic inconsistency. Recall that in the original Five Nights at Freddy's, one of the most widely mocked and memed lines was Vanessa abruptly turning to Michael and declaring she would shoot him if he ever brought Abby back to Freddy's. Yeah, taken in isolation, that moment felt jarring. But crucially, it was not representative of the film as a whole. In FNAF 2, that same energy, overwrought, blunt, and something completely coming out of nowhere, has been fragmented and dispersed across the entire runtime in small, reoccurring, cropping bursts. There is an odd, almost theatrical quality to the dialogue throughout the sequel. Characters often speak in a way that feels conspicuously contrived, as though the lines were engineered to communicate information or create conflict, rather than reflect natural human interaction. Compounding this is the film's unusual sense of rhythm. Scenes frequently snap from one location to another with connective tissue, but have this strange dilation in time. Here's an example of time passing in the film. Michael drops Abby off in school in the morning. He then goes to investigate Freddy's in the afternoon through someone who knows about it. And then he goes back to this new Freddy's and it's suddenly pitch black midnight. All the while Abby is supposed to have gone to her science fair in the morning. And she goes there and comes back too in the same day. How long is this science fair? Much of this, I suspect, stems from how the script is written. Scott Cawthon is the sole writer for this film's script, which I don't quite understand why. I don't think he wrote the first film's storyline, so I don't know why he is suddenly involved in the complete writing process rather than having an overarching word-from-God veto power. But how the writing of this film comes across on screen, I can definitely see how Scott's intentions would have translated better on paper. This film's 90-minute runtime only exacerbates the pacing problem. Even an additional 10 minutes without introducing a single new scene could have significantly improved the overall flow to the film. Simply allowing things to linger, letting tension simmer, rather than rushing to the next plot point, would have made a noticeable difference in quality, I suspect. This is most evident in the sequence where the toy animatronics leave the pizzeria, which is not a spoiler, it appears in every trailer, but I don't believe we got all that we could have gotten from that concept. The film introduces the idea, but not much occurs as a consequence of it. The same issue arises during Michael's time in the FNAF 2 office. I mean, on paper, the idea is perfect. Michael investigates how to shut down the toy animatronics in the fully, faithfully remade FNAF 2 office, complete with no door. It's perfect, and the office looks incredible. But in execution, however, the investigation largely amounts to him staring at a single window on a computer screen, hesitating over a button labeled, "Find my killer robot." And to be clear, I like the office scenes. I like the sequence where the toy animatronics are active outside the pizzeria. But everything unfolds so quickly that the film denies itself the opportunity to meaningfully exploit or even fully enjoy these concepts because of how fast the pacing is. Vanessa also suffers from this. Once again, she functions as the film's primary conduit for exposition, though I will concede this is handled more gracefully compared to the first film. Most of her lore delivery is consolidated into a single scene with Mike, rather than scattered throughout the runtime. Still, her characterization here is notably weaker, While her trauma is understandable, the version of Vanessa presented in the sequel feels flatter and frankly more irritating than before in the first film. What I think is lost in transition from the first writers and Scott is the endearing energy she possessed in the first film. She had this kind of quirky, weird vibe to her, asking Mike to dance with the animatronics begin to play and sing, willingly building a massive fort with Abby in the middle of the pizzeria with the robots, and allowing herself moments of whimsy. In FNAF 2, that eccentricity is almost entirely absent. Instead, Vanessa seems locked into a single emotional register for the duration of the film, something best described as a sustained, stoic panic attack. The lone exception to this is her dream sequence, which features some of the most striking visuals in the entire movie. Yet, even this highlight feels underutilized. The sequence only reinforces the sense that the film should have been spent more time allowing Vanessa to confront her past through these nightmare sequences before the main plot fully took over. Because unlike Michael's dreams in the first film, Vanessa's visions could have leaned far more heavily into some abstract horror and some really interesting visual symbolism, with how she internalizes and visualizes her traumatic childhood while using Mike's dreamwalking technique. Instead, it's a brief interlude, and let's be honest, it's a mechanism to bring back Matthew Lillard's William Afton. And if that's what you were hoping for in this film, more Matthew Lillard, you are going to be disappointed. Despite his outsized presence in the film's marketing and the FNAF mythos, William Afton, I think, appears even less than he did in the first movie. Abby wants to die. That's it. That is the only way to describe her behavior. Yes, she is a child, and yes, children can be reckless. But her choices go just far beyond reckless. They consistently flirt with outright self-destruction. This is not a limitation of Scott Cawthon's writing ability by any means. He created Oswald in Into the Pit and Daniel from The Silver Eyes, much more coherent and age-appropriate child characters. Yet here, Abby seems almost indifferent to her own survival. I mean, her first encounter with the toy robots, despite these characters being clearly more sentient, capable of speech, unlike the first robots, and just fundamentally unlike her original ghostly friends, who, if I recall the first film correctly, she at least could sense or perceive in the first film, were spirits. Abby here raises barely a question or a concern with them. She treats the situation with an almost unsettling casualness, with little to no questions at all to what's going on. In fact, there's a couple of times the decision-making by characters in this film are Hollywood horror questionable just throughout. Whether it be Vanessa walking into a room with only a tiny keychain flashlight as a previous police officer, Michael going into an abandoned Freddy's with nothing on his person, Abby... I think my personal favorite is the river scenes, where characters spend an inordinate amount of time wading in the water for seemingly no reason after they fall in, even when something dangerous approaches them, and both characters have shoulders that go past the walkways on the side so they could easily pick themselves up onto it at any time. They just straight up don't, and let clearly dangerous entities approach them for just a brief period of time before acting. Now, I get adrenaline, and I get flight or fight paralysis, but when the characters are just in the water wading through it without ever getting out, with no monsters clearly lurking in the water, that's not even having zero survival instincts. That's just, that's Balloon Boy's just Darwinism at that point.
Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
Taken as a whole, though, I actually think the film's core plot is very, very strong, and I think it finds its footing more quickly than the first installment. Where it falters, I think, is just the execution. A number of plot holes are just impossible to ignore, a point even Docko acknowledges in his early review. And plot holes are just not, they're not cute, they're not charming. They are fundamental lapses in the movie's internal logic, so obvious in fact that a child could identify them. I think the most egregious offender is the film's final twist. Without venturing into spoiler territory, I can only describe it as astonishingly ill-conceived. Not so bad it's funny in the way some of the books managed to be, but genuinely aggravating. An ending that actively diminishes the film as a whole, rather than recontextualizing what came before, it just undermines it. And I think it also retroactively weakened the audience's investment in the story. My appreciation for the film dropped noticeably the moment it attempted to resolve itself in this way. And I don't think I'm alone in that reaction, because while most of the fandom rallied defensively against critics prior to the film's release, genuinely positive responses afterwards surrounding its conclusion, they have been scarce online. Outside of what can be only described as uncritical glazing, I think universally this is a problem everyone has. And a common rebuttal I have also seen a lot has been, this film wasn't made for critics, it was made for fans. This is a response to the criticism the film has received. My response to that has been simply, good. Fans deserve a great film. But not an 80-20 experience where the final act collapses and drags the entire viewing down with it. That was my immediate reaction after my first screening. I left the theater my first watch genuinely irritated, rating it right then and there a 3 out of 10. It was only after a second viewing was I able to step back and appreciate the film's strengths overall, despite how deeply disappointing its conclusion remains. That made-for-fans defense also collapses under scrutiny when fans themselves raise legitimate complaints. I mean, continuing to lean on that argument starts to feel less like artistic appreciation and more like blind loyalty to a product. At that point, the conversation shifts away from storytelling and towards emotional brand protection. This is likely why so much of the praise across multiple corners of the fandom centers almost exclusively on the film's relentless barrage of Easter eggs and references to the games. And to be clear, I love them. I do enjoy the Easter eggs. If you are a longtime FNAF fan, there are some genuinely clever blink and you'll miss it details sprinkled throughout the film. But I am also older than 5 years old, and I value strong writing more than jangling keys. After more than a decade, I not only expect better from this franchise, I want better. Better storytelling means new fans can be drawn in, the universe can grow, and the creator behind it all can keep telling stories for years to come. If you truly care about an artist's work, you do them no favors by ignoring the flaws. When there's a crack in the marble, a blotch on the canvas, or a gaping hole in the narrative, or a glitch in the game, it deserves to be acknowledged. Honest criticism is not an act of betrayal. It is an act of respect. That said, if one is searching for genuine praise, there is still plenty to offer. On a technical level, the film's cinematography is just notably stronger than its predecessor. It frequently employs a lot of classic horror framing, shots evocative of the Halloween era John Carpenter, with threats lingering just off frame, gliding past the characters rather than announcing themselves outright. Within Freddy Fazbear's Pizza itself, the environment feels so strange and more unpredictable this time around, and the film occasionally leans in that unease to great effect. There are really good subtle moments, where eyes glow faintly in the darkness, then disappear, or shapes shift in the shadows so subtly that you can almost convince yourself you imagined them. And those brief, uncertain beats where the audience questions whether something was actually there or not are small but really evocative moments that I wish were a bit more present while inside the pizzeria. Again, I think that could have been fixed with a longer runtime, at least 100 minutes. Jim Henson's Creature Shop once again also deserves considerable praise. Both the toy robots and the Withers are brought to life with remarkable fidelity to the games, and visually, they look fantastic. Like, the only disappointment for me, and it's not even that bad really, is Balloon Boy. And I enjoy the scenes he appears in. It's just, during my second viewing, it became painfully clear to me that he is little more than a statue prop rather than a fully puppeteered character. So it's one of those things where it would have been nice to see him more in motion, you know? But also adding to the hilarity is the frankly laughable amount of screen time afforded to the Withers. I mean, it is comical that a significant portion of the film's budget likely went towards characters who collectively appeared for less than 2 minutes of screen time and added up.
This big brain time.
The cast of this film turned in some consistently solid performances. Josh Hutcherson, once again, excels as playing Michael Schmidt, grounding the film with an effective everyman presence. Piper Rubio, despite being saddled with a character whose decisions frequently seem engineered to ensure her own demise, delivers a performance that walks a very difficult line remarkably well. Abby in this film is defiant and ornery without ever becoming irritating, warm without veering into sentimentality. And that balance is not easy to achieve, especially for a child actor. McKenna Grace, though given a limited screen time, is a standout, perfectly embodying a early 2000s paranormal TV personality with infectious energy. Even Wayne Knight comes out of nowhere to turn in a strong performance as an egotistical science teacher. It's a character who exists almost exclusively so the audience feels no guilt whatsoever when the toy robots inevitably kill him, kind of like the Wrecking Crew in the first film. I digress, he turns in a great performance, and he was funny. And, of course, Matthew Lillard turns in a strong performance as William Afton, as well as Skeet Ulrich, also of Scream fame, partnering up with his old cast member Matthew Lillard to play as Henry Emily, and he does a very good Henry. Overall, the film does meaningfully improve upon areas where the first installment struggled, but the most significant factor holding it back remains its ending. Without delving into spoilers again, I can say that the conclusion feels less like a culmination and more like a concession. And I think part of that is the overarching desire I felt in this film to simply finish this chapter and move on to the third film, because that's where William Afton returns as Springtrap, and it is clearly the desire for both Scott, Blumhouse, and I even think the cast members themselves. The film's opening is perhaps the most overly meta indication of this mindset. I mean, you begin the film with Afton instructing a group of children to stay until the very end of the performance for a, quote, special surprise. Gee, I wonder what exactly could you be implying with that, Matthew Lillard, fame actor portraying the iconic video game antagonist William Afton, also known as Springtrap, in the hit indie series Five Nights at Freddy's? In conclusion, FNAF 2 is a film with real strengths and undeniable flaws. Internal inconsistencies, rushed pacing, and yeah, a deeply unsatisfying conclusion weigh heavily against it, particularly because that ending prioritizes teasing the next installment with a cliffhanger over resolving the story it is meant to tell. Still, the film compensates with higher tension, more confident scares, although I do wish the horror was a bit more mature, and a plot that is overall more cohesive and I think will be a bit more memorable than the first. If you are a FNAF fan, yes, you will enjoy it. That enjoyment may come with an asterisk, however, and perhaps even a familiar frustration, wondering why the films continue to diverge so sharply from the game's narrative when a closer adaptation might have avoided many of these issues altogether. If nothing else, it would have spared us the inevitable flood of videos claiming that the film somehow reveals hidden lore we never understood from the first game. I mean, could you imagine the most vocal of FNAF theorists suggesting that this film's depiction of the Withereds being prototypes of the toys was the actual lore of the second game? Five Nights at Freddy's theory crafting has long since become a temple of madness, and we are the ones who elected the orators of chaos. And with all that said, this will end tonight's program of Into the Night. I hope you've all enjoyed tonight's episode. If this is your first time listening to us, and even more so if this is not, be sure to subscribe, follow, and share this podcast to wherever you can. If you'd like to see more of our show, check us out on our YouTube, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to our Patreon to be the first to get new episodes and exclusive backstage content. I have been your host, Nick Black, and I would like to thank you all once again for listening. Have a good night, and drive home safe.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.